Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks. We have two very special guests joining us today who we're extremely excited about. But before that, Carly, will you kick us off with our disclaimer?
This is a reminder, this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer to our written notes for the fulsome picture. And there are all these ways you can support us, and we'd love to hear from you guys. Rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. Tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. Follow us on Substack, which is our newsletter, and get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. And now over to Cece.
Lovely listeners, I am so happy today because you are in for a treat. We have not one, but two fabulous acquisitions editors joining us for Books with Hooks to critique today's submissions alongside Carly, Bianca, and myself. So I'm going to read their bios. First up, we have Melanie Iglesias, a senior editor at Atria Books. Melanie joined the company in 2015 and has worked with debut, celebrity, and New York Times bestselling authors, writing in English and Spanish across fiction and nonfiction genres. Melanie is passionate about championing underrepresented voices. Her titles include national bestseller The Inheritance of Orchidia Divina by Zoraida Cordova, Center for Fiction First Novel Prize longlist selection The Boy with a Bird in His Chest by Emmy Lund, My Mother Cursed My Name by debut author Anameli Salgado Reyes, and number one New York Times bestseller It Starts With Us by Colleen Hoover. Melanie loves stories that highlight the magical in the seemingly mundane or explore new perspectives of the known in extraordinary scenarios, and is drawn to multi-layered, voicey characters and beautiful immersive writing with a commercial hook in contemporary, upmarket, and book club fiction, as well as romance, romanticy, and fantasy for the non-fantasy reader. And now we also have Elizabeth. Elizabeth Hitty joined the Atria editorial team in 2022, following 2 years working in marketing and publicity at Profile Books in London. She works on a range of best-selling book club, upmarket, and literary plus fiction, and is always looking for fantasy, romance, and novels across genres that are fun, plot-driven, and escapist, while seamlessly layered with emotional and intellectual depth. She is especially drawn to novels featuring observant social commentary, chemistry that leaps off the page, poignant family dynamics, and a propulsive plot, nuanced characters, and magic. Her first acquisition, The Crescent Moon Tea Room by Stacey Savinsky, is a Simon & Schuster's top shelf pick for fall 2024. Elizabeth grew up in Venezuela, holds a BA in political science from Vanderbilt University with minors in classical civilizations and corporate strategy, and is a graduate of the Columbia Publishing course at Oxford University. We are so pleased to welcome Melanie and Elizabeth. Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having us. We're so excited.
Yeah, so happy to be here.
We're super excited to have you, and we're super excited to pick your brains. So without further ado, Carly, will you kick us off with our first query?
Here we go. Dear Carly, greetings from Australia. I'm a longtime fan of the show and excited to share my 80,000-word literary fiction novel, The Reunion, with you. 15 years ago, at an American state university on the East Coast, four housemates in their senior year, Shelley, Annika, Madison, and Naomi, made a drunken promise to each other. They would one day have a reunion. Now, three of those women are traveling from the US to South Australia, where their old friend Naomi, our discontent, imperfect, impulsive protagonist, relocated along with Hunter, the Australian husband she met in New York as an aspiring artist. What they don't know is that Naomi has recently become separated from Hunter and is no longer living with them on their flower farm. Instead, she and their two-year-old daughter, Poppy, have been staying in an old camper van in a friend's backyard. Too ashamed to reveal her situation, Naomi breaks into her husband's family's beach house, planning to host her friends there, citing renovations as an excuse. One by one, the women arrive. To Naomi's surprise, Madison has broken the long-established rule that the reunion would be child-free and partner-free, and her two young kids and husband are in tow. As the book shifts to each woman's POV, we learn their backstories and the challenges they are living with. Although career, parenthood, and love have entirely different meanings for each of them, one thing is constant, the impossibility of balancing these roles. Annika's rock climbing environmental careers are both thriving, but she has been desperately trying to have a baby with her partner, despite the fact she doesn't really want one. Shelley, a veterinarian, has suffered postpartum depression and anxiety, which have developed into an obsession with her college boyfriend. Madison's head is a jumble of corporate decorum and financial lingo as she tries to make a power move to become a partner at her Washington firm. But she really needs to spend more time with her children, including one son who is autistic. Like the obstructed view towards the ocean from the house's patio, the women's worlds are jumbled messes of fragmented selfies. After a day at the beach, the friends head to the pub for dinners and drinks, reminiscing about a bar they used to hang out at as students. When Naomi's antidepressants get lost and found on the floor of the pub, she can no longer keep up the lie about her circumstances. And when Shelley offers one of her pills, she is also exposed. The following day, the friends band together to work a last-minute gig using flowers grown on Naomi's farm, with Madison hobbling on a foot destroyed by marathon training, Shelley sneaking pot brownies from the florist's attractive assistant, and Annika in first trimester nausea. It is Naomi's moment to shine. However, her professional strides are not matched by her parenting, which is also called into question when Poppy unleashes vulgar words at daycare and a neighbor calls the cops on Naomi for leaving the toddler napping in a warm car. Illuminating the divergence between who we believe ourselves to be and who we become, The Reunion is for fans of Rachel Yoder's Night Bitch, Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kitteridge, and Jessamine Chan's The School for Good Mothers. I am the author of the memoir You Had Me at Pied-à-Terre, which the New York Times named as one of the 5 best wine books of 2021, and the founder and publisher of the natural wine print-only publication Pipette, which has a cult following around the world. Originally from the US, I have been based in Australia since 2018, where most of my time has been spent making wine, raising a young daughter, and writing for Guardian Australia. I teach online memoir writing and food and drink writing workshops, hold a master's in cultural anthropology from the New School for Social Research, and speak French, Spanish, and Italian. Thank you for reading the attached first 5 pages of The Reunion, Rachel Signer.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, so we're going to start with you, and after that, we'll ask you to throw it to Melanie. That sounds like a heck of a long query. What is our word count they're clocking in at?
You know what? We haven't been keeping score for like the longest word count of all and the shortest word count of all. And I think we need to start doing this because this one might take the cake for the longest query letter we have ever read on the show. But listeners, if you can recall a longer one, obviously send us a message or comment to let us know. But I think, I don't know, but this one might have to start with the record for the longest.
And can I just say, I am sympathetic to the writer because they've got a big cast. There's a lot they're trying to include. So I feel their pain here. Let's see what we can do to help them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I don't know if I should start with the minutiae or the big picture here. I mean, okay, let's start with the big picture then. I mean, having such a big cast of characters is always incredibly difficult, like Bianca said. And we have a lot of sympathy for that, right? Because we're like, we have to name all of these characters if they are all main characters, explain all their subplots, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think where this one falls down for me is the fact that we don't start the pitch here with the reason that they're kind of all brought together other than the reunion. I mean, it's like a very passive, like a reunion story. Everybody's kind of heard reunion stories. We know reunions exist. Like that's not what's unique here. There has to be a unique reason that they're all brought together other than the reunion, such as somebody has to reveal something really major. And a lot of this is really interesting in terms of all these little plot points. I'm not saying that, you know, that's not important. It's more just like, what are we hooking this book on, right? Because I can't sell a book just based on like a reunion. You know, we have to have some other things we can kind of dig into here. And I think the other problem for me, which I think everybody listening or who's been a long time listener knows, I really prefer comps at the top because it helps frame my understanding of all the words to come. Whereas this person did their comps at the bottom. Other agents like it this way. And if you like it that way, again, I'm not saying you have to do it my way, but the reason that I always say comp should go at the top because again, it helps set parameters for us and expectations. And I think a huge comp that's missing here is The Interestings by Meg Wolitzer. I mean, I get the comps at the bottom here. I get them, but if this book is called The Reunion and this book is about a reunion, why wouldn't we be using The Interestings as a comp? That would be something that I would be curious about. Okay, now let me get into some of the smaller points here. So it opens with 15 years ago at an American state university on the East Coast. Right away, I'm like, this is an outsider. I'm using air quotes right now. This is an outsider writing about North America. And it is very clear. This person lives in Australia and the whole book is set in Australia. But if you're selling this book to an American audience, why wouldn't we name the university to just give us like a sense of grounded understanding? Because if you're pitching North American agents and, you know, eventually editors, right, we're going to want to know what school it is or what region. Obviously, like not everybody knows every single school on the planet. But that just to me was like, okay, this person isn't writing from here, which again is fine. But it's just, again, who is your market? Who's your target audience? What are you trying to signal in terms of who this is for? That was one thing I noticed. And then there's a lot of names, you know, I always talk about this when it comes up, but a lot of names is tricky because I don't know who the main character is. And so that's a bit of a problem. And obviously I think Naomi essentially probably is our protagonist, but there's also the mention of, you know, the husband and the daughter. Like, do we need their names or can we just call them husband and daughter? I don't know. I always hesitate with that. Like when I'm writing pitches to editors, I'm always like, do I need to include this name? Because it does confuse people when you're like, how many people do I need to pay attention to and keep straight? That's really tricky. I do think you did a really good job of keeping these names really unique. Like Shelley, Annika, Madison, Naomi, those are actually pretty unique, you know, individual names. So I do think that's great, but I have to keep them all straight through this query letter. And then when I get to the end of the query letter, I'm not like, oh, I remember that Naomi is the aspiring artist. I'm just like, these are 4 women and they go through these experiences. And at the end, I'm like, I remember that there are 4 women. I remember they have 4 unique names, but I don't know who they are. So that's, again, it's always tricky. I made a note of when I think we should cut a bunch of stuff. I mean, and it's tricky because in a literary novel, I know the minutiae of what happens in the literary novel, like is the literary novel, but the section of like, they go to the pub and then they find out about the antidepressants. And a lot of that stuff, I think we can cut because I think all we need to focus on is Naomi. Cause it's like Naomi's moment to shine. She gets called into question in terms of her parenting and Poppy and the toddler napping in the warm car. That to me, because she's our protagonist, that's what we have to keep from that paragraph. I think a lot of the rest of it can go from that section, but I'll be honest with you, like my struggle with queries like this, and I have so much empathy for this because I have to also write editor's pitches, you know, when I'm working on multi-POV books, is when somebody's like, okay, this character's all about this, and this character's about this, and this character's about this, and this is how they're all different. I think this is four different books. Like, why am I reading about these people in one book? What is the collision of like all these worlds colliding? And the fact that they're friends having a reunion, I don't know. It's just not enough, I think, to be like, what's the dramatic bomb that's being dropped? And a lot of it so far from what I'm reading is like the intricacies of their life, right? Like they're going through mental health journeys and, you know, some health journeys as well, and all of these things. And so I think I would just try to find a way to just show how these four stories are connected more than they are different, because we're going to get to all that in the synopsis in the book. And if it's explosive enough of an idea, we'll get there. And that's just, you know, what I found tricky. So I know it's long, and I think that you know it's long. You know, obviously, if you've listened to the show or if you've seen other queries, I think you have a sense that it's long. But I think you're giving yourself a bit of a, like, trying to give yourself a bit of a break here because you have the four storylines. And I've made some notes about where we think we can cut. Anyway, I will stop there and I will throw to Melanie to chime in and give your thoughts.
Hello. Yes. Yeah, no, a lot of overlap between your feedback and mine, Carly. I definitely like the comps at the top as well. Whenever I look at a query letter, I'm always thinking, how am I going to pitch this to the sales team, to marketing, to publicity? And so this is kind of the first form of that elevator pitch. So it's really helpful to know from the jump, what are the comps, which also lets me know that you know where this is going to sit on the shelf, that you know who your reader is, which is super important. And also, I'd love to know from the jump that we are going to be alternating between four perspectives, because even though she does specify at some point that Naomi is the protagonist, it's helpful to know that I'm going to be jumping from person to person throughout the novel. And so, speaking of the comps specifically for a second, I found it interesting the ones that Rachel included here, because for me, the query is long. Yes, there's a lot of great information here, but none of it really signals to me that there's a speculative element. And so The School for Good Mothers and Night Bitch both signal to me that there might be some kind of speculative element. And so that immediately puts me in one mind frame for what this book will be about. And I might be disappointed when I actually read it and it's not that. So that's another note I would have there. And so for a query letter, I feel like because we read so many of these as well, it's hard to distill it all for sure. But what I like to see is, you know, comps, elevator pitch, set up in 1 to 2 sentences. And what is the inciting incident? Before then, I feel like that last line, illuminating the divergence between who we believe ourselves to be and who we become, is perfect. That made me want to read the book. So I think that's your excellent closer. But then because we have four characters, I think it would be good to coalesce, you know, what do they have in common with the, what did they think they had in common before this reunion? And what's that inciting incident that's going to turn it all on its head without going into too much detail, like at the pub, the pills sort of thing. And I immediately wrote down a line when it says, made a drunken promise to each other, they would one day have a reunion. I wrote down like, is this supposed to feel ominous? Why does it feel ominous? What is the reunion to be like, just to check in with each other because they know their plans are going to take them on different paths? Is the reunion to show off how much they've accomplished because they set these big goals for themselves and unfortunately none of them have really met them before the reunion, but they're doing this anyway? So those were my questions about the reunion itself, similar to what you said, is like, what is the goal of the reunion? And how are the events of the novel subverting that, like, completely different from what they hoped this reunion was going to be? Those are my big notes here.
Yeah, awesome, Melanie. Thank you. Something I just want to point out to this author is take a look at the flap copy of The Celebrants. Over here, we've also got people who are having a reunion, but it's not just enough that it's a reunion. So I'm going to read it to you. Over the years, they've reunited in Big Sur to honor a decades-old pact to throw each other living funerals, celebrations to remind themselves that life is worth living. But this reunion is different. Dun, dun, dun. They're not gathered as they were to bolster Marielle as her marriage crumbled, to lift Naomi after her parents died, or to intervene when Craig pleaded guilty to art fraud. This time, Jordan is sitting on a secret that will upend their pact. So this shows you how the reunion is different this time, and that's a bigger hook there. Carly, can we go to an overview of the pages, and then we'll hand it over to Melanie first to see her take on that.
All right, so in the opening pages, we meet Naomi. She's at the mailbox. It's a kind of a small town, post office slash general store. She has some important mail she's looking at, and she remembers kind of her daughter's in the car. She runs back, and then she starts to talk about her daughter's relationship to her iPad and how the iPad has essentially been parenting her daughter over the past little while her husband get work done and get housework done and kind of reunite their bond as a couple while they have a young child. Then we jump to Friday mornings as she brings Poppy to a playgroup, and coincidentally at the playgroup, they're talking about screen time, and that is where it ends. So Melanie, what did you think of these pages?
I think for me, I almost wanted a punchier first line, because saying it was there, comma, in the mailbox, comma, the letter, it felt like one too many commas to go through. But I felt that these first pages, you really get a sense of how Naomi feels about motherhood, parenthood in general. You get a good sense of how she and her husband are struggling with juggling their relationship, parenthood, and their goals and aspirations. And you also get the sense that Naomi is sort of disconnected from Poppy at times. I noticed that sometimes Naomi is referred to as Naomi, others as the mother. Poppy is sometimes Poppy, sometimes the child. And that was really interesting to me in the sense that, is she separating their personhood from their roles in this relationship, which also, to me, brought an interesting layer. But I did worry that it was a few too many pages focusing specifically on the iPad. I felt that there was no real forward movement until three pages in onto something else, even though we're still talking about the iPad. So that would be my one note to make the first few pages a little stronger. I do get a good sense of their relationships. I just think we need to move beyond the iPad a little sooner.
Thank you, Melanie. Yeah, and for our listeners, remember, the average length of a novel is 80,000 words. One protagonist in 80,000 words means you can spend a bit more time on iPads while still paying attention to pacing and tension. But when you've got four POV characters, that's 20,000 words each. So we don't have time to kind of linger on these kinds of things that you would in a one POV novel. Okay, Carly?
I also had the same notes, which is we're talking a lot about this iPad, so that we are totally in agreement on that. But coming back to the beginning, I thought it was a very like curious opening, because we're like, what is the mail? And I felt like that block of text, it's just like a block kind of a paragraph. I almost wanted the line break, like it was there in the mailbox, the letter, line break, you know, to really just, I don't know, just like sit with that moment a little bit more. And I felt very Leanne Moriarty. So I liked that kind of tone of the writing. I liked the writing in this sample much better than the query letter, which is, I think, a compliment to writers, because I think if you're going to want to write anything better, you're going to want to write your book better than your query letter. So I think the writing is really great. I think it's very realistic. It's also very self-aware. Like, I think it makes for really good reading in terms of peering into somebody's life. But yes, yeah, so definitely a lot of iPad time. And then just, it also felt coincidental that it's like, oh, in a playgroup, we're also talking about screen time this week. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess we talk about screen time a lot as parents. And I also felt a little bit like, again, I'm a parent of young children, so I'm very, you know, well-versed in the conversation about screen time and children and iPads and all that type of stuff. I almost wonder if, like, that might date itself by the time this book comes out. I was kind of a little bit worried about that, because we have made a lot of progress in terms of, you know, how we use technology around children. I don't know. I just feel like in 2 years, would we still be having the same conversation about kids and iPads? I don't know. That was just a bit of a like, huh, I don't know, kind of question for me. But yeah, all of that, you know, I agree with Melanie on this. So thank you for your thoughtful analysis, Melanie. Thanks for coming on.
Can I ask Melanie and Carly a quick question before we go to Cece and Elizabeth? This author's clearly in Australia, and yet they're basing this book in North America. Now, when I was in South Africa and writing, I was constantly basing things in North America as well, because you think that's where these stories need to be. But this sounds to me like the kind of story that could happen anywhere. It could happen in Australia. It doesn't need to be North America. So if this author is writing North America because she feels like people don't want Australian stories, is she right? Is she being smart to do this? Or could she base this in Australia and it would still sell? So Melanie, your take, please.
I think because it's such a universal story, she can absolutely base it in Australia and it would still sell internationally, because it's a story that crosses state lines, borders, countries, and all of that.
Carly, your take?
You know, I think it's really interesting because when we got to the actual pages, my understanding was Naomi was already in Australia, right? She's the one that's in Australia. So then all of these pages are in Australia, but we opened the query letter talking about North America. So it didn't seem to like want to try to center North America in a way where it just wasn't super necessary. So I would agree with you on that.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay, we're throwing it now to Cece and Elizabeth.
Absolutely. Before I do, though, I have a very special reminder. Our longtime listeners will remember our Books with Hooks book club, a book club for writers where we essentially get together, dissect the book, discussing the specific techniques used by each author, and then have a lovely, cozy chat about it. If it sounds nerdy, it is. It's a lot of fun. Well, that book club is back for a very special edition with limited spots. Our book is going to be My Mother Cursed My Name by Anameli Salgado Reyes. To join our book club, pre-order a copy of My Mother Cursed My Name and then DM me on Instagram to secure your ticket. My handle is at Cece Lyra Agent. That's at Cecelyra Agent. I look forward to hearing from you. And now for our second lovely query letter. Here we go. Dear Bianca, Carly, Cece, and friends, thank you for the excellent education and guidance through the trenches and for the opportunity to present my query. Title redacted, 83,000 words, is dual POV adult historical fiction set in 1780 Philadelphia. It features the bold trailblazer of Audrey Blake's The Girl in His Shadow with the revolutionary spirit of Amy Harmon's A Girl Called Samson. Elizabeth is the only woman surgeon on the battlefield of the Revolution. After her brother's death in combat, she is sent home to Philadelphia, severed from her duty but eager to put her background in Spanish medicine to work. At first, she's galvanized when a handsome surgeon takes her under his wing at the Pennsylvania Hospital, but she soon finds herself embroiled in scandal, tangled in a web of bad medicine, a whirlwind romance, and murder accusations that could end more than just her dream. Catherine is torn between salvaging and reselling old books through her father's print office and falling head over heels for their printer, Taylor. Together, they secretly publish broadsides for The Cause. But when her father decides to sell the shop, she could find herself torn from the books she cherishes, the man she loves, and the cause she believes in. When she stumbles on a rare collection of foreign medical texts, not only could she secure her own freedom, she also finds a clue that could resolve a scandal at the hospital if she can put the pieces together in time. Content warning, there are 3 mild to moderate descriptions of surgical procedure descriptions. One is in the first 5 pages. I have a master's in museum studies from the University of Delaware, where I wrote my thesis on the material culture of roadside memorials. I am a member of the Historical Novel Society, and my first book, Of Metal and Earth, won the 2019 Next Generation Indie Book Award for First Novel. One of my biggest accomplishments is having rewired a 1964 Jeep in 13 hours. Thank you for considering my work, Jennifer Lane.
Thank you, Cece. Before we go to the critique of the pages, I did hear from Jennifer after I let her know she got chosen for Books with Hooks. And she said, I received a rejection recently that said publisher and editor interest in historical fiction is waning. So I'm looking forward to sharpening the edges for a better chance. Do you think, Elizabeth and Melanie, this is true? I know that this may not be your area of specialty, but perhaps you can just speak to what's happening in the market. I'll start with you, Elizabeth, and then I'll go to Melanie.
Sure. I mean, we do work on some historical. It's not our expertise per se. I would say that the main thing that we look for is that there's something very unique about the premise. So regardless of where it's set, when, as long as we want to get to know these characters, there's a question or there's something that's keeping us turning the page, I wouldn't shy away from it, but then I would really make sure that what makes your book unique is the first thing that you're saying in your query letter, and we'll get to that. But I think as long as there's a hook and there's something turning the page, you'll be surprised, and people are always open to people changing their mind. Even if they don't read historical, if there's something there, they will read it. So I wouldn't stay away from the genre for that reason, but I would really make sure that the hook and the reason to read it is really strong and the first thing that you say to the reader.
Amazing, Elizabeth. Thank you. Melanie?
Yes, similarly, and you know, with the caveat, this is my opinion. All opinions are my own. Yes, we don't do much historical fiction in our little corner, but I am always gravitating towards historical fiction from a little known perspective, a hidden figure in history who we're exploring their life and their time through fiction, which for some is more palatable, or through an epic romance sort of situation. I do feel similarly to Elizabeth that, like, as long as there's a hook there, as if there's something unique, historical fiction always has a place on the shelf. Right now, of course, folks seem to be gravitating toward romanticism more, but there's always avid historical fiction readers. And I feel like certain periods of time are always evergreen in the historical fiction space.
Thank you, Melanie. Yeah, when you talk about an epic romance, it makes me think of the book that's just come out, A Wild and Heavenly Place by Robin Oliveira. That's historical fiction with an epic sort of romance in it. Okay, Cece.
So this one came in at 342 words. I, you know, like the last query letter we discussed, so much empathy for the writer here because 342 words is a very good length. And you have to discuss two POVs and a historical fiction scenario, which always involves world building. So please know that, you know, I'm going to share my notes and we're going to talk about how this can be improved. But you've done a good job. This is a really good place to start. And I feel like there's a lot going on in your story. So, of course, this is really challenging. When it comes to Elizabeth's plot paragraph, a minor question I have is, what does Spanish medicine mean? Isn't it just medicine? Small thing, but something that I did not know. And so I was like, what does that mean? When I read, but she soon finds herself embroiled in scandal, I'm like, cool, scandal. I love that. But what does that mean? I worry it's a little too vague. But then when I got to the part about the murder, I'm like, are you burying the lead? I was like, can you maybe center the pitch around the murder, assuming it is the inciting incident? I worry that you're kind of like burying the goods here, you know, because it seems really cool. And then when it comes to Catherine's plot paragraph, it starts with her being torn between salvaging old books and falling for Taylor. Is it really torn? Because it just feels like she's dividing her time between two things that aren't really a conflict, right? Like maybe it is torn and I just don't get it, but I was not clear on that. So either change the verb or clarify. And the whole like secure her own freedom, it's similar to the embroiled in scandal. I don't know what that means. Like I am not clear on that. And again, like I said, I empathize because like how are you going to make things clear if I only get 342 words? So hopefully you can go to the back copy of books that you love, historical fiction books, told in dual POV. The last one I read was Vampires of El Norte by Isabel Cañas, and it's amazing. And that's dual POV. So maybe something to look at. I do think it's a good query letter, right? Like good query letter. I was interested to know more. I do think it needs tightening a little bit more specificity. And I'm super curious to know what Elizabeth thinks.
Thanks, Cece. I actually agree with a lot, so I'll skip the points that you just made. But what I always tell people when they ask me about queries and things like that is that really all I'm looking for is, do I want to read this and do I want to tell other people to read this? And in order to answer that question, the first sentence needs to be, what is this? And what makes it unique? So the thing I always look at is the headline. And that first sentence, even where you're saying the word count and it's dual POV, adult historical fiction, like, yes, it's giving me information, but it's not giving me information about why this book. So I would just really focus on that one sentence. And it sounds harsh because there's such little time. And so that you just want to make sure that that one sentence actually really captures that attention. And I would really just tweak that to the headline being something like a sweeping historical saga following two women in Philadelphia during the American Revolutionary War. One surgeon embroiled in scandal, the other a book salvager fighting to keep the book she cherishes and the man she loves, and whose stories intertwine as they dare to, whatever it is that they do, in this propulsive novel that features X, Y, and Z from this book that's a comp and X, Y, and Z from this other book. And that's it. That gives us place, gives us characters, gives us the two POVs. You want to insert what the challenge is, why their stories intertwine, and then you're including the comps and what about the comps, it's the thing that is featured in your book. Because that is something that when I first read the sentences, I was just kept asking myself questions like, okay, adult historical fiction set in 1780, but maybe I don't know that that's when the American Revolution was. I didn't grow up in the US. I like thankfully did know that. But you don't want your reader wondering. You want to just really put them in that place. And when it's you say things like it features the bold trailblazer of Audrey Blake's book, but bold trailblazer what? So you just want to get into more detail of what they can think about when they think of those books that your book is bringing, and really just have that in from the beginning. And then I think there's, you do a really good job of then going into the dual POV, giving a paragraph for Elizabeth and for Catherine. Cece talked about giving some more detail about certain pieces there. One thing that I struggled with a little bit was when the first sentence for Elizabeth, you set her as a woman surgeon in the battlefield, but then we quickly realized that the book is not set on the battlefield. So you do want to kind of place the reader immediately where it is, which is actually Philadelphia. So maybe can we have a scene of her in the hospital? And similarly, like she's amputating a leg or something like interesting and action packed, but in the setting that you actually want the reader to be picturing, because that is where the book will be set. And the battlefield scene could be a flashback or could be a memory later on, or even a prologue. But I felt a little taken out of place, like, oh, we're in the battlefield. Oh, wait, we're not actually in a battlefield. So there was that. I had some questions about the scandal. Like, is it her? Did she do something? Is it the surgeon who did something and brought her in? So just clarifying those pieces. And then just at the end, when you want to tie together those two stories, I was left wondering how the stories came together. Like you say that Catherine uncovers something about the scandal, so you kind of get a hint there. But I think it's worth adding one more sentence of just why the two women are connected and they're racing against time, but what is that? And what is that stake that they're fighting towards? And that really just, yeah, increases the stakes for the reader to know what is going on.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was excellent critique, and we really appreciate that. It's like, Elizabeth, the query doctor, love it. But I do love how you've just lobbed in, perhaps put in a prologue. And you may not be aware how contentious prologues are on this podcast. Not only on this podcast, yesterday, Book Twitter blew up with a huge scuffle about prologues and whether they should be included or not. So remember, for our listeners, we say if it's a prologue, it cannot be a band-aid to fix the opening pages that are not working. It needs to add value. It absolutely needs to be there alongside excellent opening pages. But thank you very much for that, Elizabeth. Right, Cece, we're going to you.
Absolutely. So our guest, Elizabeth, did a really good job with the hook, and I am now in awe of that. And if listeners, you want to steal Elizabeth's brain, I do too. Join the club. Okay, but now we're going to talk about Elizabeth, the protagonist. So Elizabeth, the protagonist, is performing surgery, being slowed down by having to teach James. We watch her in control, leading the situation level-headed as chaos surrounds her. She searches for Nathaniel briefly. We don't know who that is yet. James questions her twice, once regarding the temperature of a tool, another regarding her choice to clean it before helping others. But she holds firm in her leadership position. As she's tending to another victim, James asks if there's news of her brother. We figure out that that's who Nathaniel is, but there isn't any news. Then a soldier calls her. Nathaniel has been wounded. She goes to her brother, and throughout it all, throughout the entire scene, we have her father's supportive voice in her mind, since her father is the one who trained her. And when she does reach Nathaniel, sadly, he is dying.
As they say in the classics, holy shiz noodle, Batman. That is a lot that they've managed to fit in to 5 pages. So, all right, we're throwing it to Elizabeth now. Elizabeth, what was your take on them?
Sure. So I really like that you're brought straight into the action and you're finding out things about the main character through what is going on. I will say that, again, with the query, like, since this isn't where the book is set, I think it's a little confusing for the reader to place them there and then immediately move them. So I would actually suggest just going straight into her moving to Philadelphia, maybe in a scene in the hospital, and moving all these things that we're learning about her, that she is level-headed in a stressful environment, that she was in the war, and which was a unique situation, and she was the only woman there. She was being questioned by the people she was supposed to be training. But I do feel like we can uncover that later on in a different setting, considering that this is not the setting of the book. And I also did find myself looking for more information about her and her relationship with her brother, because we learn a lot actually about her father and the fact that her father was the one who trained her and seems to be the voice in her head whenever she's in doubt or needing advice. But it really feels like the galvanizing moment is her brother and the death of her brother, the imminent death, but we know from the Creeley letter that he passes away. So I wanted more information on him and why was she in the war? Why were they there together? Did she go to follow him because he'd been deployed? Or did they agree to go together anyway because they felt strongly about it? So just getting a little bit more information there to really connect with the main character from the get-go and just have that emotional investment so that when you do see her go through these difficult moments, you're feeling them with her. And it is obviously very tough to do that in the beginning pages, but you do want to give enough information and background for the reader to feel that way. And then just quickly, a couple of notes of just like, there are some physical elements that pulled me out as a reader from the scene, because it's good to picture where your characters are, because at one point, like, a character would be standing and then they were sitting down, or they had stepped back, but then they were actually in the surgery. So that can really pull the reader out if they're not able to follow along. And you just want to make sure to really clarify those pieces. Like, we didn't even know it was really the middle of the day until the sun is shining 5 minutes later. And it's just was a little difficult to really picture that setting and all that action all happening at once, which really pulls out the reader from the text.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Okay, Cece.
I really love that analysis, and I will skip all the stuff that I agree and talk about new points. So on a micro level, the first line reads, I could amputate an arm in less than 3 minutes, but teaching James slowed me down. Can we talk about what a great line that is? I really loved that line. All the snaps for this writer. I will, however, say this. I would change it, tweak it slightly too. I could amputate an arm in under 3 minutes, but James slowed me down. Remove the teaching. Why? Because my brain, every reader's unconscious brain, is going to go, ooh, why is James slowing her down? Is he trying to stop her from cutting off this person's arm? You don't know the reason, right? Your brain is going to start asking questions unconsciously. You don't notice your brain is doing this. And if we add the teaching, we are explaining why. And as the scene unfolds, we'll see her teaching him. So we'll understand why. So we'll get that answer really quickly, probably in the next paragraph. But that small question, that small wondering of, okay, this person is amputating an arm. Why is this other guy slowing her down? Like, is he holding her back? Is he restraining her? I don't know. That is a curiosity seed. And you want curiosity seeds in your story that work on both the conscious and unconscious level of your reader's brain. Another small note I have, micro, before I go to my macro note, is she is calling this the revolution in her head, in her interiority. Is that what people were calling it at the time? Maybe it was. I do not have knowledge of that. But I will say this. One of the biggest mistakes I see with historical fiction set during World War I is having the protagonist think of the war as World War I. Same with the Civil War. You know, you're from the South, you're thinking of it as the Civil War. That's not how people referred to the wars. Those were names that were given after the fact, years later, in historical textbooks. So it's one thing that you want to make sure it's really authentic, right? Like that interiority. If that's the proper term, ignore my note. If not, I would think of whatever term she would be using. Here's my big picture note. I see this woman who is in charge, in control, super intelligent, leading all these men, like level-headed. I love it, right? Like, this is amazing. Please, all the books where the women are in charge and the men are like crying off to the sidelines, not knowing what's happening in the world, looking for the women for guidance. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. I do need, however, her interiority to be a little bit more vulnerable and a little bit more realistic. I'll give you an example. We have a scene where she's using a tool, and the tool is supposed to be hotter, but there's no time. So she tells James, it's hot enough. We can't wait. And James is saying, it's not hot, right? James is questioning her. I love, like I said, I love that her actions are confident. But in her head, I need more. I need, is she actually sure it's hot enough? Is this a risk? Has she done this before? Is she annoyed that James is questioning her authority? Is she secretly terrified? When I say I need more vulnerability, I don't mean that she needs to question herself. Maybe she's not. But I need socio-emotional framework. Again, how does she know that it's hot enough? Right? Like, it's one or two lines zooming out to give me her vulnerability, to give me her thoughts, the stuff that she's not sharing with anyone other than us. And this happens lots and lots of times. Our Substack subscribers will be able to see my notes because I kept highlighting and being like, this is really detached. Like, I'm seeing her being in control and I love it, but her interiority needs more depth, especially when she sees her brother. There is a paragraph where she loses all control, all level-headedness, and that's great because that's realistic, but it's only when she sees him, right? Like, and he's dying. So I really, really wanted to see more interiority, more emotionality, and you will see specifically the moments that I feel like are perfect for this, but it's obviously your choice. And then as a final note, you did a really good job with the present absent character. That's the father. The father's not there, but he's present in her mind. His influence is felt. His absence is felt. Amazing job. Now, my next note might be controversial. This is up to you. I think there's greater potential for present absent characters to elevate the tension in a story when you make their influence not 100% positive, Right now, this father is fully positive, fully supportive, fully wonderful and amazing. Great. But that's not the most tension-filled situation, right? Like, I love that she has a guardian angel, but could he be a guardian angel with a caveat that would make him more human and it would make it more interesting? For example, maybe he was pro her being a surgeon, very pro her education, because that makes sense, but not being on the battlefield. So maybe she would be conflicted that she is in the battlefield against what she knows would be her father's wishes. So she's carrying a little bit of guilt, a little bit of questioning of herself. It's obviously up to you. This is just an example, but I feel like with present absent characters, if all they are is a guardian angel, you're missing a chance to really elevate attention. So yeah, those are my notes.
Thank you, Cece. Right. Thank you so much to Melanie and Elizabeth for joining us and for their incredible feedback. For our supporters, you will get access to their notes on our Substack, and you'll get Carly and Cece's notes as well. So this week, it's a whole bunch of feedback for your membership fee. So thank you, Melanie. Thank you, Elizabeth.
It was such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. It was so much fun. We always love to talk about books and help people and readers and writers.
Did you know that 70% of all books are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand to build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Do you ever wonder why so many authors publish their books and later say they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and it's all over social media. Authors really think it's a them problem, but not always. They really just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I have helped clients launch books to the bestseller list for over 15 years. I have now built a 6-module, 10-hour course with all my knowledge, and that will give you the craft and book business information that you won't find anywhere else. And there's an app. Over 100 of you have already joined my new course. And writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. Thank you, Siobhan. If you want all that info and everything that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15 for the month of April at checkout. That's POD, POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday, the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists, while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Hi, everyone. We've got a really special treat for you today. 2 authors are joining us. They've co-written a really fun murder mystery called Bury the Lead. Let me do the introductions and then I will tell you more about the book. So Kate Hilton is the best-selling author of 3 novels, The Hole in the Middle, Just Like Family, and Better Luck Next Time. When not writing, Kate works with psychotherapy and life coaching clients in the area of transformational change. No stranger to reinvention herself, Kate has had prior careers in law, university administration, publishing, and major gift fundraising. She lives in Toronto in a blended family, including a husband, 2 sons, a stepdaughter, and a rescued dog. Before I introduce your co-writer, Kate, can you just say hi to our listeners?
Hi, everyone. So pleased to be here.
It's wonderful having you, Kate. Thanks for joining us. Right. And then her co-author is Elizabeth Ranzetti, who's a best-selling Canadian author and journalist. She's worked for the Globe and Mail, where she served as the paper's arts and books editor. In 2020, she won the Landsberg Award for her reporting on gender equality. Woohoo, Liz, going out there fighting the good fight. She is the author of the essay collection Shrewd, a wry and closely observed look at the lives of women and girls, and the novel based on a true story. Her book, What She Said, Conversations About Equality, will be published this year. She lives in Toronto with her family. It's my pleasure as well to welcome Elizabeth Ranzetti. Liz, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us. It's wonderful to have you both. I love you both personally, and I'm a fan of your work as well. So this is an added bonus. So for our listeners, before we dive into the episode, I'm just going to read you the flat copy. So a big city journalist joins the staff of a small town paper in cottage country and finds a community full of secrets and murder. Dun, dun, dun. Imagine that I said that all with an Alan Cumming sort of inflection and accent. Right. Kat Conway has recently returned to Port Ellis to work as a reporter at the Quill and Packet. She's fled the tattered remains of her high-profile career and bad divorce for the holiday town of her childhood, famous for its buttered tarts, theatre, and century-old feud. One of Kat's first assignments is to interview legendary actor Elliot Fraser, the lead in the theatre's season opener of Inherit the Wind. When Elliot ends up dead on stage on opening night, the curtain rises on the sleepy town's secrets. The suspects include the actor whose career Elliot ruined, the ex-wife he betrayed, the woman he abused, and even the baker he wronged. With the attention of the world on Port Ellis, this story could be Kat's chance to restore her reputation. But the police think she's a suspect, and the murderer wants to kill the story, and her too. Can Kat solve the mystery before she loses her job or becomes the next victim of a killer with a theatrical bent for vengeance? Dun, dun, dun. Right. Liz and Kate, you have both written books separately in completely different genres. So this is a big change for you. We've got a collaboration and we've got a change of genre. Would you like to tell me how this whole project came about?
Well, I will say it was the depths of the pandemic. And Kate and I were both, I think, feeling heavy-hearted, to say the least, and looking for something to spark joy in our lives that was not sourdough or, you know, embroidery. And we got talking. We had been friends for a little while. We adored each other, and I adored her writing as well. And we got talking about how much we love mystery novels. And we thought, why don't we collaborate on a mystery novel? And that will give us something to do and to keep us from, you know, murdering our families, because we could just on the page instead. So that's sort of how it started.
I love that. I've said so many times on the show that I admire friends and writers who can collaborate. It's something I really want to do, but then I realize that I'm such a control freak that I will be such a pain in the ass of the poor author who has to collaborate with me that I don't feel like I should inflict that on another person. So I'm always fascinated by these collaborations. So another question just for you, Liz, before we dive in. As a journalist, how long have you been waiting to use that awesome title?
Okay, it is a great title, and all the books in this series will have journalism sort of puns in their title, and we're working on the second, we'll hope it will go on longer. So just for people who don't know, bury the lead is a journalism term that refers to when you put all the important information in a story far too low in the story, and then your editor will yell at you, you know, you buried the lead, kid. And I have actually had editors yell that to me in the past.
Yeah, well, one, we say this on the podcast with the queries. Often we're getting queries where people put the really good shit in like paragraph 4, and you're like, no, 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 you need to move that up to grab the agent's attention. But also it's a lead in the play. So, I mean, this pun is just perfect for this book. I just could not have come up with a better title. Okay, so Kate, I'm going to swing it over to you now. So what I'm interested in, we'll discuss your outlining and your process a little bit later in the interview. For now, I want to look at what are the challenges of working with another author, even someone who you adore, even someone you know really, really well, especially when you are both established writers before you come to the collaboration. Because I think sometimes if this is the first book you're writing together and you're learning how to write a book while you're learning how to write together, it's so much easier. So can you explain a bit, like, for you, what were the challenges personally working with Liz? You're allowed to spill the dirt. And how did you overcome those?
So I will say very honestly, okay, this has been a very beautiful and seamless partnership. And the reason for that is we had seen it go off the rails with other people. So we really knew what some of the pitfalls were, and we were very determined to avoid those. And we really set a whole lot of ground rules at the beginning about the relationship. So I'm also a divorced person, and I'm also a therapist who works with couples and other things. So I actually, like, you know, I came into this very well armed to, you know, spell out what's the contract here emotionally, right? As well as how the work is going to go. And we, as a consequence, didn't really run into any problems. So there isn't a lot of dirt to spill. We did discover that I'll tell you a little bit about ground rules in a second, but we did discover that we're both big picture kind of thinkers and not as much nitty gritty detail people. And that did show up on things like chronology and continuity. And so we had sort of a painful line edit of like, okay, this person left the room. Like, where are they now? What day is this? Shouldn't this be 3 days later? That kind of thing. So we spent a ridiculous amount of time in the proofreading trying to fix our timeline. We know better now, but that was a bit of a lesson about, you know, when you have similar strengths and similar weaknesses, you're going to get clobbered on the proofread. So we're trying to avoid that this time around.
Can I jump in there? I just want to share an anecdote. So we've had Jacqueline Michard on our deep dive series. For our listeners, she was the inaugural Oprah Winfrey book club pick for Deep End of the Ocean. And she was talking about when this happens, and she said that one of her editors pointed out to her that her character had been pregnant for 15 months, like an elephant. And that really cracked me up. And I was like, okay, I don't feel so bad, because I do stupid things. Like, someone gets bonked over the head in one scene and they're bleeding. And then in the next scene, no one mentions this wound, or, you know, the character doesn't mention how their head is sore for the next week. So these are things you have to think about. Sorry, Kate, carry on.
No, it's absolutely true. And you know, when someone else calls you on it, of course, it's blindingly obvious. But as you're rolling along, it's just not on your radar. It's not on your radar, right? So in terms of ground rules, like, if you have listeners who are interested in doing this, it's like any great relationship. So you need some compatibility personality-wise, right? And you also need to have a similar understanding about how the work's going to get done. You can control for part of that with outlining. And as you say, we'll talk about that in a bit. But for us, there was sort of a personal conversation about, you know, we both have some kids with health issues. We both have family stuff ourselves, other commitments. We both had other jobs, right? And so saying to each other, look, like, I can't enter into this partnership with you unless we have an understanding that there will be weeks where I'm not going to be able to deliver, right? Because something will come up in my life and I'm going to have to prioritize that. And both of us were totally fine with it, right? And in fact, I've been the person in the book we're doing now where there have been weeks where things have happened. My dad got hospitalized last week, right? And I've just had to say to Liz, like, can you carry this week for me? Yes. It's always yes, right? And there's a lot of grace and generosity in the relationship. I think that's the glue for us, as well as, of course, loving each other's work, respecting each other's work, like enjoying having stuff come across the desk, right? Liz wants to get in.
Jump in, Liz.
I would just say, you know, I think Kate is not being hard on herself, but I think she also has carried so much of the weight in different ways. And this is the interesting thing to me when you're talking about a collaboration, and if you can kind of look at your potential collaborator, we kind of are like two pieces of a jigsaw puzzle in that our strengths and weaknesses do fit in with each other's. I would say we are temperamentally different in a certain way, in that Kate has, I would say, maybe a more optimistic view of the world in general. And I'm very Italian, and I think like the walls are going to fall in at every second. So these two things mesh really well. And then we both hate mornings. So I think that's also very important. We are neither of us morning people. But we're also, I think, just both generous by nature. We're both kind of giving, and both of us have worked in professions before where you have to learn to collaborate with people. So that's what's been pretty useful in the end.
Yeah, I think that's important in terms of being a team player, because writing is so, you know, it's something you do by yourself, and you're in competition with yourself most of the time to make yourself a better writer. Of course, there are writers out there who feel like they're in competition with all other writers, and that never ends well. But in general, you're just trying to best yourself. And so it isn't something that you do as teamwork. So it is a recalibration in terms of, okay, this is how I'm going to approach this. I am working on a team. And it's this generosity that you both speak of, because I think the biggest thing that you want to avoid is resentment. You don't want to feel like you're carrying most of the load, that you're doing most of the work, that you have to be cracking the whip while the other person is like, la, la, la. So I think those are very important as well. You've spoken about the jigsaw puzzle in terms of your strengths and weaknesses complementing each other, and we'll get to that shortly. When you spoke about not being morning people, why is that important in terms of the collaboration of the book? Because do you both, what, do you hop on a Zoom and write together at the same time in the afternoon? Or is it just a case of, I don't want this perky woman contacting me at 7 a.m. wanting to discuss plot points? So why is that important, Liz?
It is important because, yes, we can talk to each other, you know, quite late into the night. And also, we don't wake up to a barrage of texts from the other person saying, chapter 7, why is he wearing a pink shirt? And I do know of other collaborators who have had this issue, and it becomes quite oppressive because, as you say, you end up resenting the other person. And, you know, you would wake up sort of feeling this boulder on your chest. And just, you know, to go back to what you were saying, Bianca, I honestly ended this book thinking, why doesn't everybody write in collaboration? Because it also teaches you kind of a wonderful humility about your own writing. You can't be precious about it. You have to regard it as, you know, as a work, and importantly, as a craft, right? As something that can be made better by another person. So Kate might want to say something about mornings too.
I think the morning piece is just another example of being allowed to be who you are in the relationship, right? Like, there's no expectation that I'm going to become a different kind of a writer or a different kind of a person in order to get permission to work with Liz, right? We really like who the other person is, so let's just be those people, you know? Yeah, in all of those facets, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a life lesson and a lesson for authors working together. Okay, so, but was there a challenge for each of you working with the other? So I think of some of my writing besties whose work I admire, who as people I absolutely love. But sometimes, you know, when I read their work, I'm like, you're getting into the weeds here. You know, we don't need to know that the person picked up the coffee mug with their left hand and scratched their head with their right, unless it's really important that they're left-handed and that's a clue. So for the love of God, can we please just cut back on all of that and just focus on what's important? Or, you know, another friend might skip setting entirely, you know, all they care about is dialogue. And I'm like, okay, but we need to know what these people look like. For each of you, was there one thing about the other where you had to really communicate or be like, okay, this is something that you aren't doing particularly well, or this is something you need to focus on, or was that never an issue?
I don't think it was really an issue. I think the editing process was so collaborative, right? So much gets resolved in the editing process, and I don't think we had a lot of disagreements when we sort of sat back and looked at the work. One of the things that has to happen when you're writing together is you have to try to knit the whole book together so it sounds like one voice, right? Ultimately, we did that very successfully because as we edited it, we tended to edit each other's chapters, right? And so by the end, it wasn't totally clear who had written what.
So just on that question, so did you write one chapter, Liz wrote another? Did you alternate like that? Is that how, was it like a relay? Here we go. I've written this, I'm passing it to you, and go.
So we develop a really extensive synopsis, and then from that, a really extensive outline. And then we tend to go chapter by chapter, as you say, like a relay. And then the editing process, things tend to flip around a little bit. And, you know, I think we tended to edit each other's work to tie things together. We're both too nice to say anything about each other's work. So I'll say about myself, right, that I'm very dialogue heavy on the first draft. Totally. Like, it might almost all be dialogue. And I know writing the first draft that that's going to have to get filled in. But for me to dump a first draft, I'm doing that largely through dialogue. So I know that a lot is going to get written in between the dialogue sections. But for me, that's what my first draft looks like. It looks like a lot of conversation. And Liz is better than I am. You might get better answers if you ask us this way. Liz is much better than I am, in my opinion, at kind of the descriptive stuff that goes in between the dialogue tags, right? Like, I think she's much better than I'm bad at describing what people look like because I grew up in the 80s reading like those bodice rippers, and I get like in my head tangled up with like violet eyes, raven hair. Yeah, really awkward about it. And so if you just read something by me, you'll have struggle to figure out what people look like. Liz corrects that
for me.
Awesome. So Liz, can I ask then, when you got Kate's chapters, would you look at them and go, okay, we've got a bunch of talking heads here. I'm just going to put in some dialogue tags and describe what the characters look like. Boom, I'm fixing that. And then I move on to the next thing. Or was it, I'm going to let Kate's first drafts be messy and I'm just going to move on to my chapter?
Yes. So it's a combination of both of those things, actually, a little bit. One is let the draft be messy, but also I go over Kate's chapters and she does the same with mine, and I will put in reminders for the next draft. So it'll be like, we need to say this. We need to, you know, flesh this out here. One thing that really helped, because I'm quite conflict averse and Kate is a professional conflict, you know, mender, a bridge maker, is that I said at the beginning, you know, I need honesty. I'm not going to resent anything you say, but the thing that will make me crazy is if I think you're holding something back and we're not talking about something. So like, we do have this place where we can kind of say, no, that's not working. Yes, that is working. So like right now we're in the middle of the first draft of the second book and we have a very strong outline, but yeah, you kind of look at your chapter and the other person's chapter and think, oh my God, we have so much to do here. But then I also remember, okay, in the last project, the second draft was where it came to life, where all of the detail that Kate is talking about came into play. And I have lots of weaknesses, but one is what Kate was mentioning earlier, sort of chronology. I was like, in this book we're writing now, there's a restaurant that's on, Kate wrote, on Main Street. And I thought, wait, was that actually on Main Street? And then I went back to the Bible and sure enough, it was. So thank you, Kate, for maybe you consulted the Bible on that and realized. We start with a synopsis, character sketches, and the character sketches are where we see some of the physical details and psychological ones, obviously. Then the outline, which changes as we go, but it's a very good jumping off point. Then we tend to relay the chapters back and forth, and then we don't do a lot of rewriting until the second draft.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So does all of that constitute the Bible? Is it character sketches, outline, everything? Is that the Bible? Is there anything else in the Bible that you haven't mentioned?
It's everything that's in the first book. So it's all the place names, all the people's names, all the characters, all the landmarks, all the historical details. Is there anything else in there, Kate?
I don't think so. I'm reminded, though, that here's another thing that we struggle with because it's not in our Bible. We need a map. We have to have a map. There are three lakes, right, in this. It's an affectionate nod to Muskoka, right? So there are three lakes called Hilda, Marjorie, and Jane. I, for the life of me, cannot remember, like, what is on each lake. And I'm always digging through, like, which lake is this resort on? Which lake is this person's cottage on, you know? So we do need a map at some point because it's getting more complicated.
That was going to be a question of mine. Is there a map? Because just with my last book, The Witches of Moonshine Manor, it was just a manor house. And even that, I had to have a map of each floor to figure out whose bedroom was where so that if someone was in their bedroom and heard footsteps overhead, we know who is pacing overhead. And if, you know, how many sets of stairs they had to walk down in order to get to the living room, etc. So just for that, I needed a map. So I'm impressed that you guys have gotten this far without a map, Liz.
I promised Kate months ago that I would draw a map. I do like to draw. So well, I am going to draw a map at some point. I got slightly sidetracked because I also make miniatures and I'm making a diorama of the murder scene in this first book. I know it's ridiculous, but it gives me something fun to do. I'm also working on this nonfiction book that is quite kind of serious. So it gives me something fun to do at the end of the day. But Kate, the map is coming. Don't worry, I will do the map.
There are interesting sites like World Anvil that helps you build a map. But the problem with those kinds of sites is they're more for high fantasy novels. You know, it's your Game of Thrones kind of, where is this place in relation to this place and how many seas must be crossed and is this mountainous and is this flat, etc. So I think for our listeners who are writing high fantasy, definitely check out World Anvil. It also helps you do the character sketches and really keep that many characters in place. But for this kind of book, I don't think it would be that useful. Perhaps, Liz, you're overthinking it in terms of needing the map to be really nice looking, whereas really you need three squiggles of what the lakes are and some X's as to where people live, right?
You have me down pat. That is exactly what I'm like. Oh, it looks to be beautiful and crosshatched and shading and sea monsters and la, la, la. But I just need to draw like, yeah, a grid and where everything is.
So during the phase where you were figuring out what the characters look like, do you have a vision board? So for me, above my desk is like two of those big whiteboards that I stick tons of pictures on for every book that I'm writing, including the scenes, what I picture the characters to look like, because I am not a very visual writer. When I write, I climb into the character and look out at the world. So I always forget what the damn hell they look like. And that's what a lot of readers find important. So I'll look up at my vision board and I'm like, okay, he has dark areas, amber eyes, whatever. What process works for you two? Because you have to make sure that you're both imagining the characters the same. Kate?
Well, I think we've already established this is a weakness of mine. But we do talk about it and Liz checks me on this. So Liz will often offer up a description and say, is this what you had in mind? Because this is what I'm seeing. And I'll say, yeah, I think that's right. Or, you know, I imagined him a little older or, you know, a little schlubbier or whatever it is. But I would say Liz tends to drive the visual descriptions of the people more than I do. I have a good sense of the place visually. Like, I think that is very locked and loaded for me in terms of like, I could walk those streets and I know what the landscape looks like. But the people are a little, I mean, I'm being really straight up here. They're a little foggy for me. I feel like I'm inside them as well. And I can see what their environment looks like. But I don't see them visually walking around, personally. I hear them. I can hear them, but I can't see them really.
Before we go to you, Liz, something that I want to say that I found fascinating recently is learning people's psychology in terms of what people can imagine when they read. Some people imagine the story taking place in their mind, and some people absolutely cannot imagine that. And somebody the other day on Twitter said that they cannot hear music in their mind. In order to hear music, they have to sing the song aloud. Now, my brain, I don't know how to play a musical instrument. I don't know how to write music or read music, but my brain has constantly got symphonies and pop songs crashing in it that I've never heard on the radio or ever heard before. And yet other people don't hear this at all. So to me, that's fascinating. Liz?
Yeah, just on that point, I also have recently read about people who, you know, have no visual kind of imagination. And it actually, like, it sort of panicked me a little bit because my brain is so, I have what the Germans call Kopfkino, you know, like literally a head movie all the time. There are moving visual images in my head constantly. So I do think very visually. But on this subject of description, something that really helped me was Hilary Mantel, who's probably like my favorite modern writer, once said, and she was talking about when you describe things or people, nobody describes a thing that they've encountered 100 times before. They describe things when they see them for the first time. So a character who's walking to a room for the first time will notice things, or meeting somebody for the first time will notice things. And that has really helped me actually. And when you introduce certain descriptions, I mean, obviously later you can add embellishment and things like that, but that actually was a very useful piece of advice to me.
Yeah. And this is something that, you know, beginner writers struggle with, especially when they're writing in the first person. They'll be like, I walk into my bedroom where my mirror is here and my corkboard is here and my duvet cover looks like this. And it's like, no, when you've seen something every day of your life, you don't describe it. It blends into the background. It becomes gray. That's when you need other characters, outsiders, you know, people who've never seen that character's bedroom who will walk in and describe it, or else you need to put that in the third person because it never rings true. It always feels like exposition. Right, last question, because our time is pretty much up. I just want to ask in terms of practicality. So do you both each have your own separate agents who manage the business side of things together? Do you have the same agents? Do you not have agents? How has this all worked for you, Kate?
We have the same agent at this point. Yeah. When we started the collaboration, did we have the same agent initially? Anyway, we have the same agent. And that's really, really good for us for this project. You could do it with separate agents, though. They would just obviously work together, right? To sell the property. And, you know, I know people who've done that with having different agents, but it's made it very, very easy. We're both represented by Samantha Haywood at Transatlantic, and she's amazing and we love her. And she's really been so great with this project. She was right. You know, we talked to her about sort of the prospect of doing it, and she's always been very keen on it. So that helps enormously, of course, when your agent is in the background saying, no, keep going. That sounds like a great idea. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, very much so. And this is a series, right? So did she sell this as a multi-book deal?
We sold it as a two-book deal initially. And then the hope is, right? It really depends on the readers, of course. If the readers embrace the Quill and Packet mysteries, then hopefully there will be more. From our point of view, we'd love to do it forever. I mean, it is such a joyful thing. And so actually one more thing I should say about writing together, assuming that the collaboration is smooth, right? It does go quickly. Right? You write faster when you're writing half a book, and the editing goes faster, everything goes faster. So it does give you time to work on other projects. So, you know, we both have other projects that we do. Liz is working on a nonfiction book. I recently sold a dual timeline historical mystery. So it allows us to have, you know, kind of multiple things going on. And both of us are personalities that like that.
I love that too, because what I hate is when I'm halfway through a book and the next project starts calling to me. And I think sometimes it's a procrastination tool or a fear tool. You're kind of scared of how this book will be received, and the other story calls and it seems perfect. But it would be great to be working on one thing that's totally different with someone that we can write fairly quickly and then go back to the thing, you know, that's calling to me on the side. So it really sounds incredible. Liz and Kate, thanks so much for joining us today. For our listeners, we are linking to Bury the Lead on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy the book there, you support an independent bookstore and you support the podcast and you support our awesome authors. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.